It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We uncover the secret life of the wild turkey in Wisconsin as the spring turkey season is set to take place this month in most of the state, started last month as well. State Natural Resources Department calls the restoration of turkeys one of the greatest wildlife management success stories. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. David Drake is helping us out, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, and let's talk turkey.
Let's talk turkeys. And, you know, you see them on the school's playgrounds. You see them in the backyard, city streets. I keep taking little pictures here and there. Like, they're just everywhere. Why do we see them so many places?
Yeah, they are everywhere, partly because they're an adaptive species. So they have moved into urban areas because they kind of thrive in these edges where woods meet non-wooded areas, such as shrubby areas or grassland areas and things like that. But ultimately, the reason they've done such a nice job of coming back is because we've restored the habitat that they require. So what they look for in terms of food, water and shelter, and then the space that contains those elements of food, water, and shelter. And there's pretty good turkey habitat throughout most of Wisconsin right now.
And they're omnivores, is that right? They kind of
snack
on a little bit of everything. And when I see them in my yard or neighborhood, I wonder, what do they like to eat? What do they snack on most or sample?
Yeah, they are omnivores, which means that they eat some plant matter and they eat some animal matter. And their diet will change over the course of the year. So in the wintertime, they primarily are eating on seeds, buds, things like that. Now they are nesting, so they're kind of in the middle of their nesting season. And they, once the young turkey, or what are called poults, hatch out, then they will move primarily to an insect diet. And so those insects provide a really good source of protein. And that protein is essential and needed so that those poults can grow into an adult-sized bird as fast as possible and get prepared to face the oncoming winter that we are going to be into sooner rather than later, unfortunately.
So, you know, I see them with their moms. What happens to the dad turkeys in the mating season mix?
Yeah, they're kind of the deadbeat dads of the bird world to some extent. So for the most part, the males breed the females, and then the females go off on their own, and they will lay a nest of eggs on the ground. So the our ground nesters, average size of clutch or average number of eggs that they'll lay is about 12, but it can range pretty considerably from maybe like 4 to 17, 18, something like that. And then the mom will sit on those eggs for about 28 days or incubate the nest for about 28 days. The chicks will hatch out. They're what we call altricious chicks. So as soon as they hatch out, and they all essentially hatch out at the same time within, you know, a few hours of each other. But once they hatch out, then those chicks are up and moving away from that nest relatively quickly. And so the mom will raise the chicks and as that brood or that group of chicks and the mom, and they'll just kind of move through the local area where they were, where the chicks were hatched out.
And they're too cute. They're so
they are.
Cute. Follow mom around and they keep an eye on her. And
yep.
Oh, they're so cute. So are turkeys crowding out other birds in their shared habitat? What's the relationship like with other species?
Yeah, for the most part, they're not. You know, the resources that they use, where they nest, things like that, there's plenty of resources to share amongst turkeys and other bird species. So for the most part, there is not competition between turkeys and other bird species that we see with other species, such as some mammals and things like that.
The DNR has the numbers here that the hunters in Wisconsin harvested more than 39,000 turkeys, or about 5% more than in 2021. Is there any concern about over-harvesting?
No, not at all. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, they obviously know what they're doing. They set the bag limits, or they'll sell only so many turkey tags, and they've got it figured out. So they will sell as many turkey tags as they think is needed to reduce the population. And essentially at this point, especially in the southern part of the state, there's probably an overabundance of turkeys in certain areas. And so they'd want to apply more harvest pressure versus less harvest pressure. But no, for the most part, game management or the managing of species that you're able to harvest is a very scientific endeavor, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is very good at sustainable management of game species.
What about crop damage? Is there concern that these flocks of turkeys cause farmers some headaches in planting season?
Yeah, there is some concern with that. Turkeys are not as damaging to agricultural crops as some other birds. And I know you're going to talk about sandhill cranes. So sandhill cranes are typically more of a damaging species than turkeys. Turkeys get blamed for a lot of agricultural damage because farmers see them in their fields and assume that they're doing damage. And there is some damage that turkeys will do. They will occasionally trample crops or lay down on especially young crops that are just starting to come up. But for the most part, turkeys are in fields primarily because they're in there eating insects.
Okay.
And so they are beneficial to agricultural crops in most cases.
David Drake, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Call in with what you wonder about wild turkeys, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wild turkeys, they are abundant around these parts. And as the spring hunting period gets underway in parts of the state, we learn about the wild turkey comeback story and how to apply it to other struggling species. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. David Drake is here, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist. David, you know, some turkeys last year acting aggressively toward residents in Wauwatosa, they were captured, they were killed. What would cause turkeys to chase people and to chase pets?
Yeah, most of the time, those aggressive actions take place at this time of year or in the spring, and it's mostly involving toms or the male turkeys. And what's happening right now, and has been happening for a little bit of time since, you know, late winter, early spring, is the tom turkeys, those males, the hormones are starting to surge in their body because it's breeding season. And as those hormones surge, they become aggressive, not only toward each other, toward other male turkeys, but they also can become aggressive toward pets and people. And for some reason, they seem to have a proclivity toward male carriers as
well.
What
is it? Why do turkeys go after mail trucks? Why do they want to hop on board?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And nobody knows for sure, but probably the best answer that I've heard regarding that is that the U.S. Postal Service, their colors are red, white, and blue. And if you look at the coloration on a male turkey's head or turkey's head general, but males, it's a red head with some blue coloration. And the assumption is that they can't differentiate that male carrier from another male turkey because of the coloration. And so they tend to go after the male carrier. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure, but it does seem like a plausible explanation.
Wow, there is a research study project here in the making. We just need to find that funding, but I don't want to be the male carrier subject in that research.
Maybe we can put some dummies out, dress them as male carriers.
So, you know, wild turkeys flourishing up in these parts, but the population of birds has declined dramatically in some southern states. What might be causing a drop off in other places?
You know, it could be a bunch of different reasons. I mean, everything a lot of times is tied back to habitat. So we talked about habitat being that food, water, shelter, and then the space that contains those components of habitat. And in areas where you don't have good habitat, if you were doing a lot of forestation or deforestation, logging, things like that, that might reduce the amount of habitat available. Turkeys are susceptible to certain diseases. We had the avian flu, a bird flu that came through, and that could be an issue. Down south, they tend to feed or put out bait piles a lot of times with corn. We don't do that as much up here anymore because of chronic wasting disease with deer. And prohibiting baiting where you have chronic wasting disease on the landscape. But down south, that's a little bit more prevalent in places. And there's a toxin that sometimes is in the corn that's being fed as the bait. So it could be a variety of reasons. And I'm not sure about the specific reason.
Let's go to Christina in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Sure. Thank you. I live on a 50-acre farm, and I noticed that the turkey population tends to fluctuate, and it seems like it's based on the amount of ice, snow cover that we get. And I'm wondering, at this time, should we do anything for the turkeys or just allow nature to take its course?
It's totally up to you, but again, it depends on what you do. If you're in an area, as I mentioned, where chronic waste and disease is on the landscape, it's illegal to bait. So putting out bait for turkeys, if it's drawing deer to that bait pile as well, that would be illegal. If you put out bird feeders, that's a little bit of a different story because you're feeding birds, and obviously turkeys are birds. But for the most part, these birds are able and capable to take care of themselves regardless of the severity of the winter. And even if the population gets knocked down a tad bit, it's not gonna damage the long-term sustainability of the population. And for the most part, our winters have become more mild, and especially the amount of snow cover, duration of snow cover has become shorter. And so typically, even if the turkeys can't find food for a couple of days or even a few days, they can weather that, no pun intended, and then they'll be able to find food once the weather moderates a little bit.
David, thank you for joining us and fielding these wild turkey questions.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
David Drake is a UW Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the Sandhill Crane conservation success story as the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo recently conducted a helicopter survey to locate nests in south central Wisconsin to monitor the local sandhill crane population. Call in with your questions, what you wonder about the sandhills, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ann Lacey is director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America for the International Crane Foundation. Ann, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes. Well, explain what you found in the helicopter surveys. This is the first time in a couple decades, I understand.
It is. The last time we surveyed this, so this is our study area. We have been working in this area since the early 1990s, and the random reason why the International Crane Foundation is working in this agricultural area outside Briggsville, Wisconsin, is because Owen Grammy lived there. And Owen Grammy was a wildlife artist, naturalist, famous in Wisconsin, but also knew our co-founder, George Archibald. And so that is why we started studying cranes there, and it's a high density. And so in 2003, we found 48 nests in about 9 square kilometers of wetlands that we surveyed. And so we did that same survey this year, and we only found 38. And I say only because that those numbers don't match, but we're not quite sure why, if there really is less nesting birds, or if we miss a lot of nests because the spring has been, shall we say, weird, like all this weather has been. So the birds might not have started nesting yet, or they may have lost their first nest, and it takes them a while to recycle and start a second clutch. So we might have caught a lot of pairs between nests.
So we'll
be looking into that.
Yeah, those nest numbers can fluctuate a little bit there. There's some give and take.
Absolutely.
Do helicopters overhead scare the cranes out of the nests?
Sometimes we don't even see the birds leave the nest. We're hovering rather low, not so low that we're blowing around vegetation, but low enough that we can see a bright red head. So their red skin cap on top is sometimes the only thing we see because they are so well camouflaged in our wetlands. But sometimes they sit on that nest and they will not move, and they're very defiant. And so it's a wonderful scene to see them protecting their nest like that. But we just get a GPS point and we move right on. So we're only there but for a few seconds.
What behavior are you able to see from the air that you can't observe from the ground?
Well, it's not so much behavior, although that great nest defending behavior that we see is just wonderful to see them do that. But it's more just finding the nest, and we try to take a picture of it also so we can get an idea of what kind of habitat is surrounding their nest. And it's usually, you know, it's always in a wetland, so they're always in water. How much water is variable and what kind of vegetation. It could be reed canary grass, it could be sedges, it could be cattail that they use to make their nest. So those are kind of the information that we're getting in addition to just the nest density.
So how does the survey from above compare or work with the annual Midwest crane count that took place, you know, last month? How does you incorporate that type of research?
Well, the crane count is such a wonderful way to get all people out and to enjoy the wetlands and all of the things that the wetlands can support. And that is an auditory survey. And what we're looking for is specifically nests. So we know exactly how many breeding birds there are. The annual crane count does it by ear from the ground. So you're listening for unison calls, which could be breeding birds or just paired birds that aren't nesting at all. Mm-hmm. And so it gets more of an idea of an overall, it doesn't give us a number of cranes, but it does give us where cranes are found throughout the state, because we have great coverage in the entire upper Midwest, actually, even Ohio. Ohio joined us recently in the crane count.
Do sandhills in the wild lay more or fewer eggs than they do in captivity? How does that compare?
In captivity, for example, our whooping cranes. So we breed whooping cranes here for reintroductions here and a non-migratory population in Louisiana. So we can take their eggs and they can produce more. So I'm not comparing whooping cranes to chickens, but much like chickens, they can reclutch. And they can. We're very careful about that because, of course, laying a lot of eggs can do some bodily harm to them. You know, they use calcium for that. But they lay the same number of eggs in each clutch. Mm-hmm. So a clutch of eggs typically for whooping cranes and sandhills is 2 eggs, sometimes only 1, very rarely 3. I've never seen a 3-egg sandhill clutch yet, but I know that other people have seen them. So.
Kind of like a 4-leaf clover or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, when you were overhead in the helicopter, could you get a sense of the environment or how the wetlands were doing in any way or where the nests were located in the wetlands? Any observations there?
Yeah, it was actually really amazing that we found nests in we've had a very wet spring, and a lot of just old, you know, remnant wetlands, low spots in fields that used to be a wetland that may have been drained or were full of water. And if they have the right kind of vegetation growing in them, we found that there was quite a few nests in smaller, kind of more remote wetlands rather than the larger wetland complexes that you would think would hold a lot of cranes. There are cranes in those, but the, you know, if we did a density analysis, which we will eventually, and looking at, you know, nests per square kilometer, there's a lot more nests in those smaller wetlands. They're really taking advantage of those little ones. And in the big ones, they're always typically around the outside fringe, so they can come out into those agricultural lands or pastures or grasslands that are right up against those wetlands.
Oh, that's interesting. Talking about the resurgence of sandhill cranes, their story in Wisconsin, Ann Lacey has been following their story for a while now, director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America for the International Crane Foundation. You can join in with your questions about sandhills, 800-642-1234. And sandhill cranes were once scarce in our state. They can now be seen, you know, walking around in rural urban areas. I snapped a few pictures this weekend on Edgewood College campus as I saw a pair. How did the sandhills make a comeback?
It's a really great story. And it's kind of a confluence. You know, although Leopold famously wrote his elegy to the sandhill crane, he thought that he would see them extirpated from here in his lifetime. And he Luckily, he didn't get to see that, but he also didn't get to see their comeback. A combination of wetland protections, the cessation of market hunting, led to the core areas, big wetland complexes in Wisconsin, such as Horicon and Nisida, which mm-hmm. are now wildlife refuges. And those breeding areas have spread out now. And also, these birds are very adaptable. We plowed up prairies and replaced them with agriculture, and they went, oh, okay. It's open, it's flat. This is what they like to be in. And they're right up to the edges of these wetlands that they breed in. And so that was a great combination to lead these birds to that comeback that we see today.
That's interesting. So they have a bit of everything at their doorstep.
Correct.
Other states have hunting seasons for sandhills. What do you think about hunting as a means of managing sandhill cranes in Wisconsin?
Well, the very short answer is hunting would not be a management plan for sandhills. Okay. Can they be sustainably hunted? Sure. The numbers would support that. The hunting season would not be very many permits. And I'm speaking as not a wildlife manager, so I'm probably not using the correct terms. But as for managing the population via hunting, that is a non-starter. So I try to separate those things. Cranes are hunted in this population in their wintering grounds, where we have a lot of different breeding areas from Minnesota all the way to even New England gathering together. So there's a lesser chance that any one breeding area would be over-harvested. Hmm. My concern in Wisconsin would be that some of these breeding areas could be over-harvested, which would lead to a decline in the population that we would not want to see, because these birds are long-lived, but they are very, very slow to breed, not like the turkeys that we just heard about.
Yes. So
very different ecology.
Yes, make a comparison and contrast to the wild turkeys, which are hunted.
Yeah. So both have... very, very cute chicks. I will acknowledge that. But like I said, the cranes have only a 2-egg clutch, and they could re-nest. Whereas turkeys are similar to geese and maybe other waterfowl, where they have a very large clutch, 10 to even a dozen eggs, and they breed earlier in their life. And cranes take at least 3 years to reach sexual maturity. But might not even breed, and not successfully, till 5 or 7 years. So that lag time in the breeding and the slow breeding rate really makes them vulnerable to those kind of over-harvesting.
We only have a few seconds left. Was the helicopter survey worth it? Because I know it's a lot of resources.
It is. And it was, it's great to get that compare and contrast. And we're still looking at the numbers, and we'll look into those pictures to see, what kind of areas that these birds are nesting in. But I think personally, it was well worth it.
Anne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Anne Lacy, Director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America for the Baraboo-based International Crane Foundation. And for disclosure, the International Crane Foundation is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. And earlier, we talked about the wild turkey comeback with David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.